The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Holiday business gifting season is fast approaching. This year, choose gifts that are simple to give and a joy to get. Choose Omaha Steaks. There's a huge variety, from premium steaks to skillet meals. There's free shipping on most packages, and all gifts are 100% guaranteed. Be confident in your gift choice. You can never start too early. Contact Omaha Steaks today. Enjoy special holiday pricing on the perfect business gift. It's an ideal holiday gift for your clients, employees, or partners. The perfect business gift includes 4 bacon-wrapped tri-tip steaks, 4 Omaha Steak Burgers, 4 gourmet franks, 2 boneless pork chops, 4 kielbasa sausages, 4 free caramel apple tartlets, plus you'll get free shipping. This exclusive holiday gift package is only $59.99. Go to omahasteaks.com, type Nation in the search bar, and choose the perfect business gift. Again, visit omahasteaks.com and enter code Nation in the search bar to send or experience this exclusive gift package for only $59.99. And it ships free.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Charlie Rose's CBS colleagues speak out.
There is no excuse for this alleged behavior.
Sexual harassment allegations also plaguing Capitol Hill.
There's already been some Democrats back in Minnesota who have started calling on Reagan to resign.
Plus, Zimbabwe charts a new future without Robert Mugabe.
I can't quite believe it has happened.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau, where we're celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday, along with the rest of the country and Americans around the world. First, some news close to home. As CBS responds to accusations, morning show host Charlie Rose sexually harassed young women, many who worked for him. We're now learning 3 women at CBS experienced inappropriate contact with him. Rose has been fired. More from CBS's Bianca Golodriga.
The 3 CBS employees spoke on condition of anonymity. One says she's not ready for details of her allegations to become public. The other 2 described unwanted encounters with Rose at work-related events. One claims he groped her rear. The other says he grabbed her inappropriately and whispered a sexual innuendo in her ear. Our CBS News Communications Office issued a statement saying this is new information. Beyond that, we have no comment at this time.
This is Charlie Rose.
It came a day after reports surfaced on Rose's treatment of women who worked or wanted to work for his PBS show. The Washington Post published the accounts of 8 women who described Rose groping them, exposing himself, or placing lewd phone calls. PBS has terminated its relationship with him. Former Charlie Rose Show producer Rebecca Carroll tells us she witnessed inappropriate behavior at the Charlie Rose Show, but there wasn't anybody to talk to, she says. There wasn't anybody to tell.
CBS News correspondent Bianca Golodriga reporting from New York. Rose has apologized, saying he thought he was pursuing shared feelings. When confronted, though, by a TMZ photographer outside his Manhattan apartment about the alleged wrongdoing, Rose responded, saying it's, quote, not wrongdoings. Rose's co-anchors, Gail King and Nora O'Donnell, responded to the news on CBS This Morning, Tuesday.
Let me be very clear. There is no excuse for this alleged behavior. It is systematic and pervasive. And I've been doing a lot of listening, and I'm going to continue to do that. This I know is true. Women cannot achieve equality in the workplace or in society until there is a reckoning and a taking of responsibility. I'm really proud to work at CBS News. There are so many incredible people here, especially on this show, all of you here. This will be investigated. This has to end. This behavior is wrong. Period.
I certainly echo that. And I have to say, Nora, I really am still reeling. I got an hour and 42 minutes of sleep. Both my son and my daughter called me. Oprah called me and said, are you okay? I am not okay. After reading that article in the Post, it was deeply disturbing, troubling, and painful for me to read. That said, I think we have to make this matter to women, the women that have spoken up, the women who have not spoken up because they're afraid. I'm hoping that now they will take the step to speak out too, that this becomes a moment of truth. You know, I've enjoyed a friendship and a partnership with Charlie for the past 5 years. I've held him in such high regard, and I'm really struggling because what do you say when someone that you deeply care about has done something that is so horrible? How do you wrap your brain around that? I'm really grappling with that. That said, Charlie does not get a pass here. He doesn't get a pass from anyone in this room. We are all deeply affected. We are all rocked by this.
Meanwhile, there's new sexual harassment allegations against longtime Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers. Conyers is denying a BuzzFeed report that his office paid a woman more than $27,000 to settle a complaint he inappropriately touched her. On the other side of Capitol Hill, Minnesota Democrat Senator Al Franken continues to face sexual harassment allegations. A second woman has come forward accusing Franken of sexual misconduct. Lindsay Menz says Franken, who was a sitting senator at the time, placed his hand on her bottom while they took a photo together at the Minnesota State Fair in 2010. Politico campaign reporter Kevin Robillard says pressure could mount on Franken to abandon his Senate seat.
If there's more of these accusations, will pressure build on Franken to resign? If we see a slew of them, it almost certainly will be. There's already been some Democrats back in Minnesota who have started calling on Franken to resign.
The senator says he doesn't remember taking the photo with Menz, but feels badly that she left feeling disrespected. Alabama Republican Roy Moore isn't stepping aside from his Senate campaign, as one woman tells NBC News about how he allegedly sexually abused her when she was a teenager amid allegations from other women.
He basically laid out some blankets on the floor of his living room and proceeded to seduce me, I guess you would say.
Lee Korfman was 14 in 1979 when she says Moore, then 32, sexually abused her in his apartment.
He removed my clothing. He left the room and came back in wearing his white underwear. And he touched me over my clothing, what was left of it. And he tried to get me to touch him as well.
Tina Johnson was 28 in 1991 when she says Moore, then 44, made a move in his law office.
We got up to leave, and when we did, my mother went first, and he grabbed me from behind. It was horrible. I felt uncomfortable.
Moore denies the charges, but these stories, plus his world view, prompted Alabama's leading newspapers to come out against him. Michelle Holmes is on the editorial board.
His view is radically out of step with everyday Alabama. Don't let people fool you in thinking that that's what we in Alabama believe, because we don't.
Dean Reynolds, CBS News, Birmingham, Alabama.
President Trump dismissed the allegations against Moore, speaking for the first time Tuesday to reporters on the White House South Lawn before leaving town to celebrate Thanksgiving in Florida.
He gives a total denial. And I do have to say, 40 years is a long time. He's run 8 races, and this has never come up. So 40 years is a long time.
President Trump also said it's a very good time for women, and that the sexual harassment and abuse allegations now being exposed are good for society. At least 8 people have been rescued after a U.S. Navy plane crashed in the Pacific southeast of Okinawa, Japan, Wednesday. On Monday, the U.S. designated North Korea a state sponsor of terror amid new sanctions from the Treasury Department. More from correspondent Margaret Brennan at the White House.
Whether the Trump administration's strategy will pay off this time is in question, because right now it does rest on that idea of further sanctions on the most heavily sanctioned country in the world, and getting other countries to agree to further isolate them at a way that makes it just way too costly for Kim Jong-un to continue to grow his nuclear stockpile and develop the ability to potentially deliver a nuclear-tipped missile to the continental United States.
President Trump talked with Russian President Vladimir Putin Tuesday about North Korea and a way to end the conflict in Syria. Still to come, as the FCC plans to roll back net neutrality, why the Justice Department is taking aim at a multi-billion dollar merger between two communications giants. That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey.
The budget night!
Big
folks are celebrating in the streets of Harare after Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe resigned following a military takeover of the country. The BBC's Ben Brown is there.
Car horns blaring now, and people in the center of Harare absolutely delirious. This is the moment that they have been waiting for. They can't quite believe it has happened.
Former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa is taking power now. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is calling violence against Muslim Rohingya in the Rakhine state of Myanmar ethnic cleansing. It comes a week after he visited the country, where he met with State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi and the commander of the armed forces.
The head of the FCC plans to undo so-called net neutrality rules around open internet access. Their proposal would allow giant cable and telecom companies to throttle broadband speeds in favor of their own services. The Justice Department is suing to block a merger between AT&T and Time Warner, but there are concerns the president's public attacks on CNN, which is owned by Time Warner, may have influenced the DOJ's decision. More from Justice reporter Paula Reed.
Now, the Justice Department says that no one from the White House interfered with this deal. There were reports that the Justice Department had demanded the sale of CNN, but the head of AT&T had come out and said that is not true. But there were some talks about possibly selling off Time Warner Turner Broadcasting, of which CNN is a part. Problem is, everyone will see all of these sort of complicated antitrust matters through the lens of the president's very outspoken criticism of CNN.
The U.S. has charged a hacker in Iran for breaking into HBO computer servers, stealing unaired episodes of hit shows like Game of Thrones, and asking for a $6 million ransom. The hacker, said to be working for the Iranian military, is identified as Behzad Mezri. He has not been arrested. New information has emerged about contact between Russian officials and members of President Trump's family.
Alexander Torshin is a Kremlin insider. As the deputy head of Russia's central bank, he has ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin and reportedly has links to organized crime, which is why his meeting in May 2016 with Donald Trump Jr. during the height of the presidential campaign has gotten the attention of congressional investigators. The two men were introduced during a dinner at a National Rifle Association conference in Louisville, Kentucky. According to a source, Trump Jr. and Torshin discussed a mutual interest in firearms. The source did not recall if the campaign ever came up. In a statement, Alan Feuerfass, the attorney representing the president's son, said they made small talk for a few minutes and went back to their separate meals. Ron Hosko is a former assistant director of the FBI and says meetings like this are typical of intelligence operations.
The art of getting close to someone is I give you opportunities, but I don't make you uncomfortable and I don't have you push me away.
Torshin had made overtures to the Trump campaign before. Through an intermediary, a request for a meeting with candidate Trump made its way to top campaign officials, including Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Sources say Kushner recommended against the meeting. But less than 3 weeks after the NRA event, both Donald Trump Jr. and Kushner met at Trump Tower with a Russian lawyer with ties to the Kremlin. Trump Jr. had been promised dirt on Hillary Clinton. That meeting is now a key focus in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the election. The Special Counsel's office has also been examining the firing of FBI Director James Comey and whether anyone, including the president, obstructed justice. Jeff Begay, CBS News, Washington.
How do you plead?
Guilty as stated, Your Honor.
Former USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar, accused of molesting seven girls, has pleaded guilty to sexual misconduct charges. What happened aboard an Argentine submarine that went missing with 44 crew members aboard? It reported a battery failure before losing contact with the Navy Wednesday. More from CBS News Pentagon correspondent David Martin.
They reported a mechanical problem. It's not clear whether they suffered that mechanical problem on the surface or while they were submerged. If they were submerged, they would have had to be fairly close to the surface in order to report that problem.
The U.S. Border Patrol is probing the death of one agent and serious injuries to another. Both were found late Saturday in a culvert near Van Horn, Texas, not far from the Mexican border.
FBI and Border Patrol agents have scoured the rocky desert terrain by foot and air. They're looking for evidence after what's being called an attack. It was around 11 o'clock Saturday night. Border Patrol agent Rogelio Martinez went out to investigate an alarm triggered by a ground sensor. Martinez called for backup when he determined it was set off by human movement. According to the National Border Patrol Council, it appears he may have been ambushed and attacked with rocks. A second agent arrived to find Martinez unconscious, bleeding from the head. That second agent radioed for backup. Both agents were then discovered with serious head injuries, both possibly victims of a stoning. Martinez, who's been a Border Patrol agent for just 4 years, died from his injuries. His partner is now in stable condition at University Medical Center in El Paso. Art Del Cueto is vice president of the National Border Patrol Council.
It is consistent
with having been assaulted with possibly rocks.
This incident has renewed calls for tougher Border Patrol measures. President Trump tweeted, "Border Patrol officer killed at southern border, another badly hurt. We will seek out and bring justice to those responsible. We will and must build the wall." Here at the hospital, the surviving agent apparently has no memory of what happened. David Begno, CBS News, El Paso, Texas.
A Nebraska commission has approved a proposed route for the Keystone XL pipeline through the state. It removes the last regulatory hurdle to the $8 billion oil pipeline project. Larry Wright Jr., a tribal leader in Nebraska, has been fighting the project.
We'll continue to fight the Keystone route and what it means for our water, for our land, for our future generations, our resources, and all those natives and non-natives that are impacted by this.
The decision could still be challenged in court.
Well, I think I love you.
Partridge Family actor David Cassidy has died at age 67. He was suffering from organ failure. Cult leader and serial killer Charles Manson died in prison Sunday. Correspondent Steve Futterman looks back at his life.
I didn't have nothing to do with killing those people, period.
The unrepentant words of a notorious killer. Charles Manson died at the age of 83. The man responsible for one of the most horrific murder sprees of the 20th century died of natural causes. In 1969, Manson was the mastermind of a two-night killing spree here in L.A. that shocked the nation.
Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate.
They became known as the Tate-LaBianca murders. The victims' bodies were brutally shot and repeatedly stabbed by devoted members of Manson's cult-like family. In his warped mind, Manson hoped the killings would start a race war. He called it Helter Skelter. Manson was found guilty and sentenced to death in 1971. That was later reduced to life in prison. California officials are now trying to determine what to do with Manson's remains.
Up next, just in time for Thanksgiving feasts and leftovers.
A smile shows it's safe. A wheat icon means gluten was detected.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS News Radio podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like The Evening News and Face the Nation on demand. Or hear original audio programming like our Week in Review show, The Weekend Roundup. Get politics, policy, and a side of pop culture with White House correspondent Major Garrett on our newest show, The Takeout. Get these podcasts and more from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. People with food allergies are turning to a new technology.
Jolene Warren was diagnosed with celiac disease about a year ago.
I had severe anemia, and my red blood count was terrible.
Celiac is an autoimmune disease triggered by gluten found in wheat, barley, and rye. It's commonly controlled through a strict diet.
Food was my social activity. And since then, I eat as much as I can at home because that's my safe spot.
But now this pocket-sized gluten detector is helping her to eat out more and worry less. The device from Nema Labs scans a sample of food placed in a disposable capsule.
Got a happy face. Right.
A smile shows it's safe. A wheat icon means gluten was detected. Nema researchers are now creating devices for other common food allergies.
We're developing a test for peanut, for dairy, for tree nut, eventually anything you care about. We want to give you that instant information in the palm of your hand.
Still, Nema admits it's not a 100% guarantee. While the tested sample may be safe, that doesn't mean the entire meal is gluten-free. Dietitian Emily Luxford thinks the technology is helpful, but worries users may become too dependent.
So they don't know how to use the proper tools of asking questions and communicating with restaurants or reading labels, and then they feel like they can't actually make a choice without a device.
Jolene uses her detector at least 2 to 4 times a week.
I don't go anywhere without my tester to make sure that I'm safe.
An added layer of security helping her cope with her condition. Chris Martinez, CBS News, Santa Barbara, California.
Some people suffering with epilepsy are fighting to expand access to pot. Correspondent Barry Peterson in Denver meets one family suing to allow greater access to the drug.
Well, ever since I've been on this cannabis, I've actually been seizure-free for today. It's 974 days, so we're coming up on 1,000, so I think that's pretty good.
Pretty good indeed, because this was once the life of Alexis Bortel. Seizures every few days. Her parents say epilepsy medications didn't work, and there was even talk of brain surgery.
What do you call epilepsy?
Well, I call it my seizure monster.
But this seems to tame the seizure monster, an oil made from marijuana taken twice a day. Her family lived in Texas, where they couldn't get the oil they needed. But they could in Colorado, where both medical and recreational pot are allowed. For her father, Dean Bortel, the decision to move here 3 years ago was an easy one.
I would die for her, right? So the least I could do is uproot my life and give her a chance at the exact same freedoms and future I had.
You'd do it again?
Twice on Sunday.
Are you adjusted to being here?
We've been here about 3 years, so we're adjusting.
Alexis hopes the lawsuit will make medical marijuana legal across the country.
Do you think it's unfair that this medicine is not available to everybody in the United States?
I think it's really unfair because I feel like they're basically punishing us because we're sick.
But some medical experts are not sure. Jacqueline French is the chief scientific officer of the Epilepsy Foundation.
We really need more research to find out what's helping, what's hurting, whether people should opt for this over some other options that they may have.
Alexis has turned her epilepsy into her cause, making soap and donating the proceeds to charity, even writing a book. But all she really wants is just to be a kid.
And does it make you also feel more normal in your regular life?
Yes.
Why?
Because I can, let's say, have a sleepover at a friend's house without having a seizure.
Why did you think people would listen to a 12-year-old?
Well, I feel like it wouldn't really matter because it's the right thing to do. And I don't think I need to be over 18 to do the right thing.
Both the Justice Department and the DEA turned down our request for an interview. As for Alexis, she lives her new normal one day at a time and hopes that using marijuana will keep that seizure monster away. Barry Peterson, CBS News, Denver.
There's a new look at an old profession, surgeons, and the grisly work they did in the world of Victorian medicine. Historian Lindsay Fitzharris wrote about it in her new book, The Butchering Art. Thanks for talking with us, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what surgery was like in the 19th century.
Well, it was a lot different from how we do it today. We're talking pre-anesthetic, so people, the patient was totally awake. And you imagine these theaters filled to the rafters with hundreds of spectators who were often ticketed. They came in just to see the spectacle of life and death on the center stage. And they brought with them the grime and dirt of everyday life. So this was entirely an unsterilized environment. And the patient was put onto a rudimentary table in the middle of the theater, totally awake, and the surgeon would come in wearing his blood-encrusted apron. He rarely washed his hands or his instruments because he had no concept of germs. And it was a very brutal and dirty affair.
And they'd also visit, what, graveyards?
Well, yes. In the early part of the 19th century, bodies were hard to come by. And so you had the resurrection men and the body snatchers stealing bodies from the graveyards and selling them on to anatomists to be dissected. And there was a lot of mass hysteria around this. You get these stories about villages discovering that a body's been stolen from the local graveyard, and they all go to the graveyard and they dig up their relatives and drag these coffins back to their homes in order to protect the bodies.
So there's a lot of challenges that medicine faced, especially surgery in the 19th century. And then along came this man, Joseph Lister. Why was he so significant?
Well, I think a lot of people, if they're familiar with Lister's name, it's because of the product Listerine. It was named after him. It had nothing to do actually with him, but it was named in honor of him. But what Lister does is he takes germ theory. He takes Louis Pasteur's germ theory, and he applies it to medical practice, and he develops antisepsis or germ-fighting techniques. And when he developed his techniques, there was a lot of pushback. Because imagine this young surgeon coming along and he's telling you that there's these invisible little creatures and they're killing your patient. And it was really hard for the medical establishment to accept that.
So how did he eventually convince them to start changing things?
Lister, when he comes along with his theories, with germ theory and antisepsis and his methods, there's pushback. He basically decides that he's going to have to turn to the younger generation, and he starts training his students in these methods. And they go out into the world, and they're known as the Listerians, and they start spreading the gospel, so to speak, of antisepsis. He also comes to America in 1876. He goes to Philadelphia. He's invited by his own enemies to speak, and he goes to demonstrate his methods, and he actually wins over a lot of hearts and minds on that trip.
Historian Lindsay Fitzharris, author of The Butchering Art on the Weekend Roundup. Good talking with you, Lindsay.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, how retailers are trying to lure you offline and into stores.
It could be a makeover. It could be meet the chef. It could be decorating services.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Some advice for shoppers looking to get a holiday deal this week from CNET's Bridget Carey.
The Black Friday shopping bonanza is upon us. As you sketch out your plan of attack, keep these basic rules in mind to avoid getting suckered by a bad deal. For starters, always do a little background on the gadget. Is it brand new or last year's model? We have seen some nice sales advertised on last year's Roku, which is still perfectly good, along with last year's Beats Studio wireless headphones and last year's GoPro Hero 5. Amazon always has tons of sales, and many of its smart speakers and tablets are going to have great discounts. But what about the other random stuff on Amazon? There is a ton on sale. How do you know what's really a deal and what's a dud? Well, there is a site that tracks Amazon prices, and it has a strange name. It's called Camel Camel Camel, and it will give you the price history of everything sold on Amazon, so you know if a sale is actually a good sale. Now, there are a few things that are never a good deal for Black Friday. Do not buy mobile chargers, phone cases, or accessories. Those tend to be overpriced when you're swept up in the shopping rush. When it comes to cheap tablets, look to Amazon. The Fire 7 tablet is only $30 when it's on sale. And when it comes to the Turkey Day gadget rush, research from Adobe Analytics says Thanksgiving Day offers the best prices on computers and video games. Black Friday is best for buying appliances, tablets, and TVs. And Cyber Monday always has plenty of sales, but toys usually see the best Monday price cuts. Bridget Carey, CNET.com for CBS News.
Stores are going to new lengths to reel in customers.
At the Eddie Bauer store in Columbus, Ohio, the retail environment is decidedly chilly. Freezing, in fact.
Okay, so this is an actual block of ice.
It is.
I'm going to sit on it.
They created an ice box, chilled to 16 degrees, so customers can try out their cold weather gear. It's something that can't be done online.
People come here on repeat visits?
Absolutely.
For the novelty to test out the clothes?
Well, yes, to test the outerwear, for sure. That's what it's intended for. It's just a great experience.
Like Eddie Bauer, retailers across the country are looking for ways to lure customers offline.
We have some cookies.
And into their stores. Melissa Miller is with Alliance Data, which helps businesses market to customers and try to retain them.
It could be a makeover. It could be meet the chef. It could be decorating services.
It's why Saks had its Wellery pop-up, part fitness center, part shopping experience. And Macy's is partnering with Samsung at its flagship store in New York in the hopes that virtual reality turns into actual sales. Empty stores aren't sustainable, but novel efforts to coax customers through the doors come with risks.
Well, if it seems like a gimmick, today's customer sees right through it. They might check it out once, but they're not going to be responsive to it.
It is estimated that in the next 5 years, one in four U.S. malls will close. So the effort to get people to shop in stores is urgent for these retailers. Alex Wagner, CBS News, New York.
Before leaving for Mar-a-Lago, President Trump took part in the annual turkey pardon at the White House.
Drumstick, you are hereby pardoned.
47-pound drumstick and companion 36-pound wishbone will live the rest of their lives at a Virginia farm. On Monday, the First Lady welcomed the White House Christmas tree, which arrived, as usual, on a horse-drawn carriage. A group of girls from Long Island, CBS News first met in 2011, is raising the bar to do more for families in Cambodia. Here's CBS News correspondent Elaine Quijano.
The little kids just kind of live like on the street.
Back when Emmy Specht was 8, a family trip to Cambodia opened her eyes to a nation's needs.
To see it as a kid. So tell me again, how did that change you when you saw the poverty?
When we just like noticed how much we all have that we kind of take for granted every day, just something as small as clean water that other people need, and we use it every day. We don't even notice it.
So Emmy, her sister Ray, and their friends took notice, starting the charity Four Girls for Families. Their first project was funding and delivering 600 water filtration systems to Cambodia.
I thought that it was really a great cause.
That's Maddie Joannidis at age 12.
In Cambodia, you would see all the dirty water that was there.
And Maddie Joannidis today.
So we've delivered almost 3,000 of these water filters.
Improving a country's water supply helps prevent death and disease, but impacts so much more, says 17-year-old Ray Specht.
So a lot of the young women in the villages, because they did not have access to clean drinking water, it would affect their whole lives. Like, they would have to walk for miles each day to get clean drinking water, so it would prevent them from going to school.
So we grew from doing water filters to building wells. And a lot of these wells were built at schools so that kids could bring water back to their family.
While we're on the topic of schools,
we've also just finished a new project that we're really happy about, the Sret Ket School for about 500 kids.
That's a pretty big accomplishment.
Yeah, it was pretty daunting to start.
High school junior Eloise Cosse.
You know, visiting that school was probably one of the highlights of the trip, you know, talking to the students, really making a personal connection, and seeing firsthand what we've done.
Do you think about them when you're here?
I do. Sometimes when I just get a glass of water, I think, you know, I wonder what that girl at that school that I talked to, I wonder what she's doing now, and I wonder if she now has clean water because of us.
I love it.
They now sell Cambodian crafts to raise funds. Their new goal, a second school, and a second generation of siblings and other volunteers for the project.
And you think you'll keep working with Four Girls for Families?
Yes.
Why?
Sam Specht is 11.
It's the right thing to do if someone's in need. You should make a difference.
Elaine Quijano, CBS News, New York.
Forbes magazine is out with its list of the highest paid women in music this year.
I'm Gary Nunn. Beyonce leads the list, earning $105 million pre-tax from record sales, including her sixth solo album, Lemonade, her Formation concert tour, and her fashion line, plus other business interests. Number two,
hello, it's me.
Adele at $69 million thanks to her album 25, a world tour, but no major endorsements. Taylor Swift topped the list last year. She earned $44 million this year. Number four, Celine Dion at $42 million. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
NASCAR losing a popular star driver.
The great driver Dale Earnhardt Jr. finished 25th in his final race as a full-time NASCAR performer on NBC. He's retiring at age 43.
Hey, I just want to thank everybody that's had an impact on my career. I've made friendships and relationships that'll last a lifetime.
Earnhardt, the son of a racing legend, will now go to the broadcast booth. One of the things he did during his career was lure Martin Truex Jr. to the sport full-time. Truex won the race in Miami and at 37 claimed the NASCAR season title. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Coming up, how the world's almanacs changed after 150 years.
We have a lot more sports now, a lot more pop culture.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great shows like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all from your Spotify app on your iOS or Android device. CBS News Radio on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS News Radio podcasts today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Atlanta's Georgia Dome turned to dust Monday.
12 seconds. That's all it took to drop the 29-story Georgia Dome and reshape Atlanta's skyline. But this explosive moment took nearly 2 years of planning and prepping.
The last time any fan got to step foot in here, it was a little different scene.
In its final days, the Georgia Dome looked like an apocalyptic ruin. And nothing like the home of the NFL's Atlanta Falcons for season ticket holders like Matt Dale.
For 3 years, I think I was section 119, which was somewhere over here, which looks like it's just a pile of concrete now. So
Dale felt conflicted when we met him. His job has been to oversee the implosion of a venue that has staged a quarter century of milestones and memory.
Nation, can he get in?
Two Super Bowls, three Final Fours, and in 1996, this is where Team USA Women's Gymnastics won their first Olympic gold.
Any major event that came to Atlanta, you know, if it came to the Dome, you knew it was a meaningful event.
And deciding to get rid of a building like this is a complicated and frequently emotional decision.
Absolutely. You know, it was studied for a long time and debated, but I think ultimately realized that, you know, in order to keep major events coming, that a new stadium was necessary.
The Dome's lower bowl was the first to go. The tricky part for demolition man Rick Capitelli was up above.
And I looked at that and I've never seen that before. I've been doing this a long time. I've never seen that before.
How to bring down the half-mile-long concrete ring beam that wraps around the roofline, a one-of-a-kind design.
And what was the solution?
One implosion to do the entire structure.
Throughout the Dome, workers drilled 3,000 holes, and in those holes placed 4,800 pounds of explosives, all timed to cripple the ring beam and columns in just the right order.
The sides will go off first. 33 milliseconds later, the center goes off.
For more than 40 years, Steve Pettigrew has been making buildings go boom. But this job ranks as one of his most challenging.
On a scale of 1 to 10, it's up beyond a 9, that's for sure.
Here's why. The Georgia Dome sat sandwiched between Atlanta's major convention center and the city's new crown jewel, the $1.5 billion Mercedes-Benz Stadium, just 83 feet away.
So you've got this narrow cone to make this happen.
Exactly right. The Falcons have a game 6 days after we drop this, so we've got to be careful.
So you've double-checked the numbers, triple-checked everything.
Quadruple-checked the numbers, and we feel good, yeah.
For all the planning, the venue's final performance should have been no surprise. The Georgia Dome could always hold an audience.
But all did not seemingly go according to plan. One section there still standing on the southeast corner of the stadium. But there also seems to be a second issue, and that is another section that did not go completely into the middle and did not implode with all the others. And that's on the opposite side on the northwest section of the stadium. So they're going to have to figure out what to do about those two challenges. So apparently the Georgia Dome still has one more final encore.
Mark Strassman reporting from Atlanta. The World Almanac is celebrating its 150th year. You remember those big books at the school library filled with the world's facts, data, and history. Senior editor Sarah Jansen is on the line this weekend. Sarah, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah, there's a lot of different types of almanacs, including the Farmer's Almanac. How has the World Almanac changed?
Well, the World Almanac was meant to be, as one of its first publishers, Joseph Pulitzer, said, a compendium of universal knowledge. And that's sort of been the guiding principle over the past 150 years. But of course, what is universal knowledge has changed a lot. So we've been changing with the times all along the way. A lot of notable things we've noticed when looking back over 150 years is that we have a lot more sports now, a lot more pop culture, but we're still looking at, you know, history and science and all of the other information that people expect to find in the World Almanac.
How does then an old-fashioned, really, reference book like the Almanac adapt to the digital world? Because, listen, encyclopedias haven't done so well.
They sure haven't. I mean, the cost point of a World Almanac is quite a bit lower than a full set of Encyclopedia Britannica, so that certainly helped us. I think a lot of people like to still have the print edition just to flip through, because there is something sort of serendipitous about picking up a book that covers literally every topic you could possibly be interested in. But we also have a pretty substantial online presence.
So Washington is heavily featured in the latest edition, including President Trump. So how does the Almanac describe his administration and the election? Because it seems like so much of how we think about those things change so often.
Yeah, I mean, covering Washington, I think, for everyone who pays attention to politics was a bit of a challenge, not just this past year, but really for quite a few years now, because there are so many different narratives that seem to be colored by your leanings left or right or center or upside down sometimes. So it definitely is a challenge to keep up with everything. You know, just looking at one policy proposal, like, say, the travel ban or the healthcare bill, you'll see that iterate 15 times within the course of, you know, a month. So covering that is definitely a challenge. What we try to do is just try to stick to the facts, try to source really, really, really well. And hopefully we've done a good job of covering the ups and downs in Washington of over not just 2017, but we have a great new feature that looks back at the entire Obama presidency and gives a really good overview of that as well.
Well, I am a lover of almanacs and atlases. Senior editor Sarah Jansen, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much.
A milestone for Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip Monday.
91-year-old Queen Elizabeth and the 96-year-old Duke of Edinburgh were all smiles as they posed in front of a platinum backdrop fitting for their 70th anniversary. They're celebrating with a small family party, but no public events.
A bride and bridegroom.
Back in 1947, Princess Elizabeth married her Prince Charming, Naval Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten, in a lavish wedding that offered a reprieve from the hardships of a war-weary Britain. Just 5 years later, it was Philip who broke the news to Elizabeth that her father, King George, had died.
Royal experts say his support has been one of the secrets of their success. But they add, like all couples, the two have weathered their ups and downs. Through weddings and wars, beginnings and endings, their marriage has survived and thrived. At Westminster Abbey, where the couple married 70 years ago, bells rang out throughout the day in their honor. Terry Okita, CBS News, London.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup Thanksgiving edition. We're thankful you're listening. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dori Valerio is the production assistant in New York. Alyssa Rashaw is our intern. Have a great week. Steve Dorsey, CBS News.